Hey everybody, welcome to another episode here in the zone. I'm Giancarlo Lino. That's Chris Martelli there. Big episode here, episode 191. We got to kick it off with some big news in the NHL because after a month of speculation, almost 2 months of speculation on where Phil Kessel will land, the news finally broke. Phil the Thrill is heading to Vegas. He joins the Vegas Golden Knights. Only 1.5 mil, which is kind of surprising to join a team like that, but Chris, what are your thoughts when you heard the news of Phil Kessel going to Las Vegas?
At first, I was very happy for the guy because this is it's an opportunity for him to show his true colors. Now, everybody that's talked about Phil Kessel talks about the hot dog loving milk bag. You know, this is a guy that's going to break the Iron Man streak. This is a different type of Phil Kessel we've never seen before. The longevity, the consistency of him being healthy is just... It's amazing, man. And, you know, the fact that a team like Las Vegas, where, again, they've had injury problems the last 2 years. Leonard's been hurt. Jack Eichel had that the neck displacement or whatever it's called. And, you know, Mark Stone has had his fair share of injuries. So you get a guy like Phil Kessel. At $1.5 million, I think that might be one of the biggest steals. If this guy can play second line, get 50 points, compliment a player like Riley Smith, compliment a guy like Chandler Stephenson. Like, Vegas is right there again, man, to be a bubble team, a playoff team. They don't have a number one goalie going into the year with Robin Leonard. I think it's Thompson who's going to be starting. More of an unknown for me, and you know me just as much as a lot of other people. I'm a huge hockey fan, so the fact that I don't really know him that well is concerning, but you get Phil Kessel for $1.5 million, dude. Like, that's a bargain. Like, I was saying to you 5 minutes ago, I'm surprised there were not a lot of teams out there that were willing to give him $3 million. So, yeah, you know, Phil Kessel's not going to get you 80 points anymore, but he's still a guy that's definitely going to bring that veteran leadership that consistently, specifically when injuries happen, which they do every year, you're going to see a guy named Phil Kessel who hasn't been injured in 989 games. So, it's a great signing for Vegas just based off the narrative that they've had the last couple of years with the injury bug. And if I'm Phil Kessel, going to Vegas, baby, that's a good life.
Yeah, Phil the Thrill. It's only $1.5 million of salary, but the kind of luck he's had off the ice and that kind of realm there, he's going to hit the jackpot a lot. So I think he's going to be a fixture there in all those casinos. And Kessel on the ice, I think, like, him and Eichel, I think that's going to be an underrated partnership. On the power play, he can join in. If Mark Stone is struggling a few times, maybe even put Mark Stone with Phil Kessel, both on the wing with Eichel. I think there's a lot of possibilities there. You have Pietrangelo on the back end. So leadership is there. Phil Kessel, Stanley Cup pedigree, him and Pietrangelo have won. That's three Stanley Cups with those guys. And I think this team is going to be sneaky. If you can get a goalie that's a little bit more consistent in net, fill that void, this team's going to be a problem. And Phil Kessel is looking at just some of the posts here, and big milestone for him this year. He's going to break that Iron Man streak because I think it's pretty close in, from Arizona. It shows the Leafs game that Vegas is coming for. He could tie the NHL Iron Man streak, 989. And then against the Coyotes in that Mullet Arena, 5,000 people, it's 1,000 consecutive games. Do you think he'll finally get that video tribute from the Leafs?
I hope so, man. This is a guy that, like I said to you, the most underappreciated right winger the Leafs have ever had. And we've had some underrated right wingers. I can name a few. Nikolai Kuhlman, Sergei Berezin back in the day. You know, we had McGillney at the end of his career, but Phil Kessel, man, this is a player. When we got him, he was a huge factor to ticket sales, to marketability for the Leafs. We know the Leafs are always going to be a sold out ticket, but with Phil Kessel and what he was doing back in the day without a centerman, man, that was just absolutely amazing. And still the fact that this franchise has the nerve to not give him a proper video tribute to this day, it just baffles my mind, man. He led the team, what, 5 of the 6 years he was here, or maybe even every year? Just, I don't get it. I think he needs it, though.
Yeah, I think just the disrespect there. Like, he's a team guy that made this team even entertaining and even a thought of making the playoffs a realistic target. Like some of those years, the guys that were on his line, like Rickard Wallin, you had had Joffrey Lupul, who didn't have the best of reputations with his injuries, and he made him over a point per game. Then, of course, Lupul got injured, but he was productive playing with Phil Kessel. He made Tyler Bozak into a more reliable center, a hot commodity in the league. JVR, the story that he told of Phil Kessel making him a player in the league. So Phil the Thrill has been around. Versteeg was another one of his line mates. Like, everybody seems to be playing better when they play with Phil Kessel. He goes to Pittsburgh, and you would think he would get that video tribute from the Leafs. So for them not giving him that, I think that was kind of disrespectful. But hopefully Kyle Dubas and everyone in charge give him that when he comes back, because I think he deserves it for this kind of streak. But we'll go on here to some other news. And Chris, we were talking about Brooklyn. KD, like, what was going on there? The Raptors were in the mix. Boston was in the mix. Miami was in the mix. Phoenix, he decided to stay, and they said it's a partnership with Brooklyn. So I don't know what the hell to make of that, but he said it's a partnership and not that he's playing for the franchise. Is this a good move for Brooklyn?
I mean, for their ticket sales and the way that the team is looking, I'll say yes, but for a very short term. I think it's already been one. This is going to be his third season in Brooklyn. The first year he didn't play because of injury, and then last year was a very underwhelming season. I hate to say this and put all this pressure on Ben Simmons, but I think it's really up to Ben Simmons and how he plays and how he progresses as a pro athlete. We've seen, like, Zion Williamson, we just saw was out for 17 months with an unknown, I guess a lot of people say it was his foot, weight problems. I'm not really sure. I don't really want to get into that. But with Ben Simmons, man, like, this is a guy that came in the league, was compared, I hate this, like, I don't like saying this, but he was compared to LeBron James coming in. Like, let's be real here. People were saying he's a LeBron James physique with a Magic Johnson passing ability. That is ridiculous expectations coming in, but the guy hasn't been healthy for a while. Obviously, no one should take mental health, casually. If he really does have those problems, I really hope for the best for Simmons, but with the back injuries and a lot of the serious injuries that he's had to overcome, this is a big wait and see for a guy like Kevin Durant, who, again, is 33, 34 years old. You don't necessarily know in terms of loyalty, man, with KD and Kyrie. This is like a flip the coin. I feel like, I'll give you a scenario, Alina. Let's say by February they're in seventh place in the Eastern Conference. What do you think a guy like Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving are thinking? Do you think they're already thinking ahead to the offseason, saying, yeah, we're not going to be here next year? Because that's what it seems like it is every year with these two guys. So, again, it's great for the time being that KD is still in Brooklyn, but I wouldn't be surprised if this narrative, by next June, it comes right back up again.
Yeah, I agree. Because Ben Simmons, like, remember the playoffs? We were talking about him even playing maybe game three and game four. He didn't play either. And it looked like those guys were pretty pissed about that. KD, for sure. Like, there were talk of him saying, like, you know what? Ben Simmons let the team down there. And I think after that, KD's whole mindset, something happened, because it looked like he wanted out, especially when the Kyrie stuff was happening. But I'm with you there. Like, I think if this team isn't in the top four by January, I wouldn't be surprised if they're looking at the trade deadline, because it's an NBA, and we saw with James Harden, he gets traded around that time to Philly. They do that deal when that's a team that had a big three. So I would not be surprised if KD is lurking around and looking at the standings a little closer than usual to say where his next destination will be.
And another thing too that I think a lot of players in the Eastern Conference forget is that teams in the Eastern Conference, man, are improving, like, a lot. Like, Cleveland is a team that you should not sleep on. Atlanta is arguably better than Brooklyn now with Dejounte Murray. You have the Raptors, who are just, they continuously improve every single year. Make no mistake about it, man. The Eastern Conference is a lot harder than, I want to say, players in the conference, a.k.a. Kevin Durant, I think, assume it is. I think it's still Giannis's conference. I think he's the best player in the league. Kevin Durant is a guy that could definitely be a top three player on top of his game. But just the way we've seen Embiid progress, the way we've seen Jokic continue to be consistent and dominant, I don't know, man. Like, Kevin Durant was rumored to go to a couple, even Western Conference teams, go to Phoenix. I heard the Clippers were another team out there that were kicking tires with him. Even Golden State, like, there were just so many teams out there that I think, honestly, the best bet for Kevin Durant would have probably gone to the Western Conference. But him staying in Brooklyn, I know it's the boring option. There's not much drama, not much results in terms of changing the landscape of the league. But I think for Kevin Durant, man, this is a move that's very iffy because he has voiced that he wants to win championships. He wants to solidify his legacy, getting more than three rings, getting one by himself, you know, being the centerpiece of a team. I don't know if he can do it with Brooklyn. I think that ship might have sailed 2 years ago. Because 2 years ago when they had Harden and Kyrie, what was it? They lost in game 6 or game 7 in Milwaukee. Like, I think that might have been the closest they could have gone to win it all. So last year's sweep, I think, was a kick in the nuts for everybody in Brooklyn. And I don't know, man. Like, Boston, they just improved tremendously. They got Malcolm Brogdon too. Like, I don't know with Brooklyn. I feel like, again, in the year, I will say it again, this narrative might come about again. We might have another case, Alino, of deja vu with Kevin Durant.
Yeah, and I think it's crazy. Like, this is a team, like, they played so well, you would think, in that first game that they were going to turn it around. And I don't know what happened after that. Like, KD couldn't really get his groove.
Drop a bucket.
Like, yeah, Kyrie was struggling so much. So I don't know how this is going to change. I think Ben Simmons is going to help a lot, but you're counting on a guy who didn't play at all last year. So he's going to come into this like cold as hell, and it's not going to really help anything going forward. Kyrie and Kevin Durant are in their own world now with what they see this team going forward as, and I don't know what they're going to plan on doing, because it looks like James Harden staying there probably would have been for the best, but they lost everybody and got to rely too much now on aging KD. They could have got the other offers if they accepted it. They went too hard, negotiated too strong, and it bit them in the ass.
What do you think would benefit Brooklyn in the long run, Alino? Do you put Ben Simmons at the one and you have Kyrie more as like a shooting guard, or would you just keep it status quo, have Kyrie be the number one, maybe go with a little bit of a bigger front court? You have maybe KD at the three, Simmons at the four. Which it's the same narrative when it was in Philly. Like, where do you put Ben Simmons in the starting rotation?
Yeah, that's a tough one too, because he's such a good passer and he's a good defender, but you know he's not shooting any threes. So right away, if he's a point guard, that takes away the threat, and you know he's going to look for a pass all the time. If you put him as a power forward, it might help more KD if he's outside and looking for open shots. But this might sound crazy, I would start Seth Curry still in that number two spot, put Kyrie at the number one. Maybe even go small and have KD at the five, Ben Simmons at the four, and just kill teams inside the paint. But
that'd be interesting, yeah.
Steve Nash has a tough job right now because he's managing egos, and he has Ben Simmons. Now he has to worry about his ego, too, of being this great perimeter defender and passer, and he's going to demand the ball a lot. Kyrie, there's only one ball to go around, so good luck on Steve Nash. Good Canadian kid.
And I felt so bad for him, man, when there was so much pressure on him, 2 weeks ago, saying, yeah, like, this guy might be fired. It's like, it's not really his fault. He had a lot of off-court shenanigans to deal with. He had to deal with Harden. He had to deal with Kyrie and Katie being very unhappy at a certain point in the year. So Sean Marks and Steve Nash, to me personally, they are not the problem. I think they've done a hell of a job with the circumstances given. But Alino, I got to ask you this question, because there was a really good player on that team last year that didn't play at all. And he's a really good shooter. And his name is Harris. Joe Harris is going to be back in the lineup full time next year. I'll name you three players, because I want to just quickly cancel out the stars at this point, because that's all we talk about. Simmons, KD, Kyrie. Let's forget about them for a second. out of these three players that I'm going to mention to you, which one do you think would be the biggest X factor for success next year? Seth Curry, Cam Thomas, who we've seen be an absolute bucket, or the returning Joe Harris?
I would have said Joe Harris if it wasn't such a bad injury. Like, he missed a lot, and like, just to get his form back, I think would take a lot to even get back to where it was before. But I'm going to go with Seth Curry. I just like his journey to the NBA, and he had to work hard to get there. And it wasn't like Steph Curry where he's just highly touted pick. He stuck with his shooting and it got him to the situation. And he had some big moments there in the playoffs. So I'll go with Seth Curry in a full year, full off season with this team, working with Steve Nash. I think this could be their X factor. And eventually when they do trade KD, because I don't see him staying for the full year, I think Seth Curry is going to be like that third option to get points for the team.
Yeah, and another thing too, I agree with you with Seth. I would have said Seth too. It's just for a guy like Seth Curry to go in the lineup, and when his shot is going, it just relieves so much pressure from a Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant. Let's say they're getting double teamed. We saw in the postseason that one game, Kevin Durant had more turnovers than points scored. That's a stat that should never, ever be a thing with Kevin Durant. So when Seth Curry is on his game, let's say he goes a game, Alino, 5 of 8 from three, shooting lights out, they win by maybe 5. Without Seth Curry, they're not winning that game. So I do agree there. I think Seth Curry is an absolute X factor. And looking back at that Harden trade, I don't know if Philly, I don't know if they won that one in the long run, man. You're getting rid of a guy like Seth Curry. That's a tough pill to swallow. And we know how great James Harden can be. He's a great facilitator. If he gets his health and his cardio back to that elite level that it was at in Houston, maybe we could see him average 25 again, but he doesn't have that explosiveness anymore. I don't know if he can get about 23 points per game, but still that facilitating maybe evens out Seth Curry's shooting. But Seth Curry, I agree, absolute X factor for Brooklyn.
There was another trade too. Speaking of X factors, Beverly and Russell Westbrook are supposedly going to be teammates now. Westbrook can obviously be bought out or traded by the time this podcast is over, but Beverly's going to the Lakers. And what surprised a lot of people is all of a sudden the Lakers are willing to trade Horton Tucker. When Kyle Lowry was lurking in trade discussions, they were kind of saying, you know what, no, he's our untouchable. And now they trade him for Patrick Beverly. Did they make the wrong move, not traded for Lowry when they had the chance?
This is an emergency trade, I can tell. This is something where you look at Pelinka and it's like, we need to bring a true leader into this locker room. You know, Carmelo Anthony, unfortunately, looks like he's not coming back to the Lakers. Dwight Howard, I think, is gone too. So they bring in Thomas Bryant, who's a young center. Like Russell Westbrook, I think, honestly, Alino, with this trade, I think it's a foregone conclusion. He's not a Laker. You can't have Beverly and Westbrook on the same team. There's no way that's a thing. Just the amount of feuds that those two have gotten into, it's one thing to have maybe KD and Westbrook link up again because of how great their legacies kind of intertwine with each other. But with Beverly and Westbrook, they hate each other. Like, that's like having Rondo and Chris Paul on the same team. That's just not working out. So I think I'm going to make a prediction, Alino. Call me crazy. I think the way that the Spurs got rid of DeJounte Murray and Lonnie Walker, I think Russell Westbrook, if he really wants to have that, astronomical bet on yourself type of year, I think him going to San Antonio with Popovich in one of his last years coaching, I think that would be a good option for Westbrook. But you hit it right there, man. Like, they trade Talen Horton-Tucker, a guy who's under 25 years old, a great three-way scorer. He could score in the paint, the mid, and the three-point. If Donovan Mitchell somehow leaves Utah, Alino, call me crazy. If we're doing a fantasy league, get Talen Horton-Tucker. That guy might be averaging 18 to 19 points a game next year. So, again, they have Lonnie Walker off the bench. They have a couple pretty decent guys off the bench, the Lakers, this year. But make no mistake about it, trading arguably one of your most up-and-coming players for Patrick Beverly, it's not it for me. It's not it.
Do you think Westbrook is going to push hard for a mutual like bio? Just get me the hell out of there. And then he joins the Clippers with Paul George and Kawhi, which they were trying to get the Raptors to do a few years ago.
If Russell Westbrook goes to the Clippers, you already know we're going to see another Westbrook for John Wall again. No, but it's up to, I know Ham, the new head coach, is a big Westbrook fan. So I think if it comes down to the coach, I don't see Westbrook leaving. But again, I've said this so many times, Alino, you know, this is a player dominant league now where all the players have the say, they have most of the say. They could say, hey, Rob, I want to get out of here. Please respect my wishes. I want to move on. I think he'll have a trade in a week top. So whether he goes back to OKC now with Holmgren out for the year, whether he goes to San Antonio, I think regardless, I don't see Westbrook really thriving in LA. And that's no knock to Beverly. I think he's a great leader. It's just I wouldn't trade Horton Tucker for a 10-point per game type of player. It's just not it.
And I guess their expectations, like Beverly, is he moving the needle for this team? Like, what is he going to offer, you think, to the Lakers?
I think they just want him to be the best defensive player that, because again, we saw last year, they're one of the worst defensive teams, man. They allow a lot of points. Like moving the pill, absolutely not. I want to say he's a guy that'll average 4 assists. LeBron's probably the point guard next year. Dude, the ball's always in LeBron's hands. Like 80% of the game, LeBron has the ball. So I'll say LeBron, you put him at the one, the mismatch, obviously, it's the Ben Simmons effect. You put LeBron at the one, you put Beverly, maybe he's maybe the sixth man. So he's going to be the point guard bench player. But other than that, man, I don't see a lot of like successful structure around Patrick Beverly. To me, that's the biggest question mark, is why would you trade a guy in Talen Horton Tucker, who's been with LeBron for the last 2 years, 3 years, and just trade him for Beverly? I don't get it. And again, how much confidence is Beverly going to have? He's been traded twice this offseason. Like, you know what like, I mean? Like,
imagine he went to the team. He went to the team and they're like, yeah, you know what? We've got you. Nah, we're going to trade you again. Sorry about that, man.
I mean, I'm pretty sure he was amped to go to, where did he go? He went from Minnesota. Was he a Clipper? Where was he? He went somewhere. I'm trying to remember where he went. It's not coming to me right now.
Yeah, he's been traded so many times. You almost lose track. I know it was looking like it was going to work in Minnesota because they actually went to the playoffs. It looked upbeat from there, but I don't know, for whatever reason.
He was on Utah. He got traded to Utah. See, Utah probably would have worked because he would have got the touches and he would have probably started. And, you know, they would have got their guy in Wembanyama next year in the draft. But, like, dude, the guy's going to L.A. He's going to be in very limited minutes. It's bad enough that Beverly's vocal as hell. So this could be really bad, man, honestly. It could be a bad fit.
Speaking of bad, transition now to AEW, where it looks like it is getting bad.
It's getting bad. I don't know
what's happening there, but Jon Moxley squashed CM Punk like he was Goldberg, and he's now the undisputed champ. There's all these reports of behind the scenes of CM Punk. What are your thoughts of all this? Like, are they prepping for a CM Punk heel turn, or are things just bad in AEW right now?
That's best case scenario. If that was all just for a CM Punk heel turn in a couple weeks, that's a huge risk, because you're doing it at a very – it was marketed, that match. So we'll say that. That match was heavily marketed, two titles on the line, kind of like what happened in SummerSlam 2011 with Punk and Cena. Same ordeal, you know, very marketed. And you have a guy like Jon Moxley and Punk who do have that history. And then to go out there and put on a match like that, just, I don't know. That, to me, that was one of the biggest disappointing title matches I've seen in a very long time. And no knack to Moxley. You know me, Alino. I'm not the biggest Moxley fan, but that match could have been a lot better, a lot better. Even if you were trying to get the message across of Punk is still injured and not fully healthy, you could have gone, I think, a much better direction. He goes up for a kick and hurts his knee or foot, whatever it was, and then just ends him within 2 to 3 minutes. I don't know. you probably have a better understanding of me. What do you think about this whole thing? Because to me, I don't think it really benefits Moxley that much.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it was kind of odd the way they did it too. It wasn't the main event. I think if they wanted to go with that shock factor of, wow, Moxley just beat him in like 3 minutes, I think they should have had this as a final segment. Maybe do this at like 9:45. Everyone is expecting this match to go like 20 minutes and end the show at like 10:05. But this happened right at 9, and then they ended the show with a 6-man tag, which was kind of odd. Like, this is the undisputed world title, and 6-man tournament title is taking precedence on that. So I think it would have had a more impact if they did that later, but like, I'm with you. I don't think this really serves anyone. And I already just saw here on Twitter, I pull it up here, that the rematch is happening at All Out. So like, are you expecting, if CM Punk doesn't turn heel or anything happens there, will you be disappointed in this?
Absolutely. I think this is going to be a setup for Alino. I'll ask you this. Do you have him turn heel before the match starts, like for the buildup, or do you have it more of like a Daniel Bryan 2018, like mid-match, low blow, something, you know, underhanded to get the title back? And I don't know if the tough thing with Punk, Alino, is everyone's going to cheer. There's always some people that are going to cheer it. It doesn't matter. Heel, face, tweener, it doesn't matter. But in this instance, the way that they built this match, especially with Moxley squashing Punk and flipping him off and all this stuff, I just feel like it didn't benefit Moxley at all. If this was a thing where Moxley wasn't coming off holding the belt, coming in maybe having a streak, you know, going like 9 in a row winning, then maybe I would have seen Moxley as more of a threat moving forward. But now with Omega back and Ospreay now being there off and on, and Hangman Page is always going to be in the mix, and even a guy that's not even on TV who I think is going to hold it eventually, an MJF, I just feel like the CM Punk heel turn, it does have a really high ceiling. But with Jon Moxley holding the belts, man, again, I'm not dissing him. I'm not calling him underwhelming. It's just, how high of a ceiling does AEW's main event scene have with Moxley holding both belts? I don't know.
Yeah, I think the timing's weird too. Like, it's in Chicago All Out again. So obviously, like, if he does turn heel, I don't think the crowd would even care, or they'll know about it. Like, they're still going to cheer him regardless. So I think Moxley, maybe they should have teased as a heel, and then after All Out, maybe on the Wednesday when they have Dynamite, that's when CM Punk could turn heel and start something. But I think they're backing themselves in a corner here, and hopefully it leads to something positive. But it's just odd that CM Punk and Moxley already have a match, and then literally a week after, they're going to have their All Out main event, which is like their biggest show of the year, with the rematch of something that happened on free TV. So I don't know how they're going to book themselves out of this one.
I heard a rumor. Now, I don't know if this was true or not. I heard that Moxley was the guy that pitched the idea of having the match before All Out. And I feel like Punk was not, he wasn't accepting of it. I think he wanted to wait a bit, and maybe it was him being petty, saying, yeah, I can't, like, okay, like, I'll do this match, but it won't be more than 5 minutes. Like, I don't want to be out there for long risking an injury. And then you saw, I assume it's all kayfabe. I don't think he's actually hurt, but if he is hurt, then that's definitely another big problem for AEW. But there's just so many options for me when you look at the growth of talent in AEW and the guys that are trying to, you know, break the ceiling, kick the door down, whichever theory you want to call it, of breaking into the main event scene. Dude, you have El Idolo, you have Andrade, you have Malakai Black, you have so many guys that really want to be in that spot. And yeah, you know, CM Punk brings the big bucks, it's in Chicago, yada yada yada, he's coming back, he's making a comeback in wrestling. But if you're not going to bring the passion, you're not going to be there for the big time feuds, and these have all been speculations backstage, and you know me, I'm a huge CM Punk guy, but if you're not going to properly go through the process, do you actually deserve the shot here? So I'm really hoping, Alino, that this is going to be a 4.5-star match at All Out. I'm really hoping it, but because what we saw on Wednesday was just, that was embarrassing, man. That was like, I look back at all the CM Punk's matches that I've seen in my lifetime, that might be one of the worst in terms of a title.
Yeah, didn't do any favors there. And Speaking of one positive or some of the positives from the show, Ricky Starks just comes out. That promo, amazing. And a little bit of Ric Flair in there. He just takes off the jacket, just tosses it, it goes nuts. And I think they have something here. Like, should they, after this whole matchup with Powerhouse Hobbs, like, if he's not in a main event scene or even the TNT title picture, like, is this going to be a disappointment from AEW?
Yeah, absolutely. Unless you put him in a solidified singles feud, like what Omega's in right now. But other than that, yeah, you have to build this guy. This guy's money. And this is another AEW hidden gem, at least for me. Again, I don't know as many guys in AEW as WWE. Obviously, it's still a product I'm learning every day. But seeing his promo and the potential that he has, man, it's high. It's very high. I think he can be a top 10 player in AEW for the next 5 years if Tony Khan wants to invest this time and money into Starks. And Powerhouse Hobbs, I think it's a pretty good first feud for him. I think he's going to go over him easily. You maybe want to call me crazy, Alino. Would you maybe, with all the momentum with MJF, with the mystery factor with him, do you maybe put Ricky Starks in a feud with MJF to maybe kick off his singles, this singles run for him? Or would you have him go up against a guy for the TNT title or maybe Moxley down the line? Because I think him going up against a guy like MJF would be absolutely incredible for his career.
Yeah, that would be money. MJF, if he comes back as a face, you can always turn him as a heel and say MJF only came back just because he hated CM Punk and he got the fans and like everything on his side. He just wanted the money and build up a heel character even more. But yeah, I think those two need to be a main event feud down the line, because obviously Starks as a heel was okay and he did his job, but I think as a face is where he's going to really shine. And MJF as a heel, we haven't really seen him as a face too much, but I think as a heel is his best work. And those two together, I think, would at least make AEW. Yeah, at least make AEW, like the fireworks of a feud like that. It would make them identify like, okay, those are AEW guys, not a WWE guy coming in and building a name with some young up and coming talent.
That dude, that, call me crazy, that could be as highly anticipated as a CM Punk and John Cena. Like if MJF's on the top of his game as a heel, Ricky Starks is on the top of his game as a face, it's fireworks. Like that's going to be the program of potentially the decade. So I do, again, I'm maybe making this a little bit too soon. I mean, they're both still relatively trying to get their feet wet, get the titles, get their resume going. But if you have those two go at it early on, and MJF, man, he's young, but he's solidified. He's a guy that, you know, he's proven he can go with the best of them. And here, Alino, I want to transition into this. So you say a CM Punk heel turn is on the way. MJF coming back, being a face. What do you think that makes AEW as a program? Do you really want to see a face MJF? Because I'm curious to see the pops he would get, because I feel like him as a face could be money for AEW.
Yeah, I think it would be perfect against CM Punk too. Like, you have him come out, I think everyone was cheering him when he did that little shoot promo.
Oh yeah,
they're all going nuts. So I want to see that. Like, I want to see him come out as a face for now, and then eventually say he only did it for the money, his contract was up, and then go back to being the old MJF. So I think he needs to take advantage of this. I think AEW need to take advantage of it and make sure he's a guy that when he comes back, it's going to be a meaningful pop for their fan base and something it can build on.
I agree, man, 100%. I think he comes back, plays the hero for, 2 weeks, and then flips the switch again. So that'd be good. But I want to ask you, because we're talking about Ricky Starks, other than, you know, MJF, would you have him maybe win a battle royal to go on to face CM Punk? Let's say he was the champion, or do you think that's another possibility that's too soon? Because another name for me that pops out for Ricky Starks is, I think, Chris Jericho. I think that's on any wrestler's bucket list to feud with Jericho. Maybe, you know, call me crazy, after Christian Cage's feud is done with Jungle Boy, maybe have Ricky Starks go up against Christian Cage. I don't know. There's a lot of options with veterans, though. If I'm a guy like Ricky Starks, you see Christian Cage and Jericho as heels in the company, I'm circling them on my list for sure.
Yeah, I'm with you for sure. Like Christian Cage, like just him playing this asshole character is phenomenal. And then you have Chris Jericho there, and when he's done with Bryan Danielson and that whole Garcia feud, I think Ricky Starks and Jericho is another one that's money for the end of the year. But yeah, I agree with you. Like those are two bucket list guys. Like if you're a face in AEW, those are the two heels I think you want to work with.
Exactly, man. Either way, though, Ricky Starks has a great future. He has a hell of a future. To me, would you say he's like the Austin Theory of AEW?
Yeah, I would say that. The guy who has a lot of potential, not really in the mix yet, but you know, eventually he's going to be a mainstay and somebody that can hold his own both in the ring, on the mic, and get a character going. I think that's a fair comparison.
Yeah, he's great, man. I love Ricky. I wish him the best.
And on this note with AEW, we have to talk about that ending there. Ospreay, Kenny Omega, and they're building towards that tournament where next week these two teams are going to go at it. Kenny Omega, though, a little too taped up. Is this a cause for concern that maybe his in-ring ability might be limited and he may have rushed back?
Yeah, I hate to say it. I think he might have maybe forced himself back a little too soon. Maybe Tony Khan gave him a timeline after the injury saying, we need you back for All Out. We need you back at a specific time. You know, it happens, man. Some people come back early. Some people, you know, it takes a little longer. Some people are right on course. I think with Kenny Omega, he's heavily relied on. He's one of the big time players in AEW, and going up against a guy like Will Ospreay, who this is to me, man, this is one of the biggest dream matches that I think I can put on my list of all wrestlers that are performing as of right now. So AEW has a firework type of match of the year, match of the decade almost, if you want to maybe, I mean, it might not be with Omega the way he's been moving, but you never know, man. It could be a shoot. He could go into All Out, take off the tape, and we're good to go. But yeah, no, I agree with you. Just what I've seen from Kenny, he does still look a little bit banged up. Him and Punk, I don't know. I don't know if it's probably a work with Punk, but with Omega, I don't know if it is. He looks a little bit slower paced. I don't know if it's the injury. I don't know if it's him being cautious. Maybe again, it's a typical show for him. So when it comes to pay-per-view, maybe he's saving the one or two few moves, two few energetic spots, but I'm so happy, man, that they're going with Ospreay and Kenny. This is going to be, regardless if he's 75%, 100%, we're going to see fireworks.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Just having Kenny Omega back is positive for their brand, and he's one of the guys that started this whole thing. He was the main player that they signed after Jericho when his contract came up, and they rely on him a lot, and it shows with that title reign. But we'll go to WWE now, who had their fair share of surprises. Johnny Gargano in Toronto comes out, no rumors, nothing. All of a sudden his music hits and out he comes that he signed with WWE again. Did he make the right move here?
Beautiful move. Yeah, absolutely. Triple H was always a big fan of him. I think the WWE universe was all rooting for this move too. It's one of those things where you look at Tommaso Ciampa finally being up on the main roster and the fact that he wasn't signed by anybody. Again, this is the type of guy, you look at his credibility, his in-ring work, his resume, you would think he would have been signed February. No, when did he get April? So by like May, he would have been signed somewhere else. So he was obviously looking at his options, but I think he knew deep in his heart that WWE was always his number one option. And I think Candice LeRae, man, I know she's not back yet, but I think we're going to see her probably in the next couple weeks, whether that's on NXT going up against Mandy Rose or maybe up on the main roster. I think you're going to see Candice LeRae and then Johnny Gargano back at it, doing their thing. But again, I will say this, Alino, I think it's one of the best moves for him in his career. For WWE in general, this is another face that might get a world title shot that we've never seen before. And you know, you have Gargano coming back, Cody Rhodes coming back. There's a lot of fresh faces in WWE that really does change the trajectory, not only of the company, but of the titles moving forward. I'm very excited for Gargano being back.
Are you surprised that they went in this direction? Like, they had Dexter Lumis come out during the Ciampa match, get The Miz and, like, kidnap him. But then they had like Gargano come out this segment after, you would think Gargano, if he's going to come out, it'd be to start something with Ciampa, and Dexter Lumis is on his side and their faction, but he's going now to feud with Austin Theory, who was the other guy in that faction. Like, do you think it's going to show signs that the faction is done, or they're just going to go with Lumis and Gargano?
I think the way it's looking right now is maybe you do one-on-one for now, Theory versus Gargano, see how that goes. But as it kind of goes on, and as Dexter Lumis, he's probably going to, I think that whole kidnapping Miz is definitely going to be a way of him getting a contract. I think he's going to say, listen, I have the Miz here. I have him hostage. Give me a contract. So again, a lot of people are saying he's a face now. I'm not really sure if Dexter Lumis is a face as of yet. We'll see. But if you have Lumis and Gargano as faces, I think that could be absolutely beneficial. Maybe they can talk Ciampa into becoming a DIY reunion. You have Lumis maybe as like a body type of guy, like a manager, but we all know that's probably not going to happen. Lumis is going to get his spotlight, but I love him facing Theory, man. It comes back full circle. Without Gargano, Theory's not necessarily there and as successful, so I like the way Theory came out. Dude, he got very emotional. You saw he almost started crying, Theory, there. So there's definitely that emotional tension there and presence, and it's probably a very important stepping stone for Theory, too. I think Theory's going to win this feud. I mean, it's a win-win regardless. If Gargano wins, he moves on. If Theory wins, he moves on. He always has the briefcase. So my biggest question is, though, with you, Alino, with Gargano maybe feuding with Theory, does that point to signs maybe of a Theory more successful cash-in, or do you still think the failed cash-in is still an option here?
With him now, like, coming in there, and like you said before, fresh faces in WWE and especially on Raw, I think it makes it more likely that Theory cashes in and successful, gets a WWE title, goes to Raw, and we have all these guys, then Drew can come over and challenge them. You got Gargano now all of a sudden elevated to a main event spot. And who, like, Theory, it doesn't have to be a long reign, but everyone's going to be focused on that title run. So I think chances are going up now with Theory's Money in the Bank cash in.
I love it, man. It's funny too, because I was watching the segment and I'm like, okay, this, like, a month ago, I didn't want Theory winning at all. But now that I'm kind of seeing Gargano come back into the mix, you see Kevin Owens become the prize fighter again. Looks like he's a face now. I don't know if it was just the Canada thing. I don't know, but he did go up against Gable and Otis, and the crowd loved it. Papa Powerbomb is back. So do you see, you know, with Kevin Owens maybe even being in the mix, I'm down for Austin Theory winning the title, man. I just think it's different. It's fresh. It keeps Drew McIntyre occupied too. So I love it, man. I know Roman Reigns, his reign has been absolutely legendary, but everything comes to an end eventually. So I think Theory might be the guy to end it for Roman Reigns, especially his WWE title run.
Yeah, and especially now too, Roman Reigns re-signed with reduced dates. So doesn't have to do every single live event anymore. Like, I guess they're going to be more selective of when he comes out. So I think that can also be a sign that they're looking at maybe taking one of those titles away. And there's Austin Theory right there. Drew McIntyre, Clash of the Castle, that's another one. And you look at all the guys on Raw that can come up. Like, Randy Orton eventually is going to return. He can be in that mix. Kevin Owens. So you got an exciting mix over there on Raw.
What do you see with Roman Reigns, man, in the future? Like, in the next 2 years, do you see him potentially on his way out? Because I'm not really, like, we have the talent. You have Seth Rollins, Cody Rhodes, who can carry potentially one brand, and you have Drew, Gargano, and Kevin Owens on another brand, and even Theory. So what do you think about Roman Reigns potentially departing a little sooner than expected?
I think he's going to probably, I wouldn't say like John Cena, where he's going to be in like multiple, like 3-4 matches and then leave for like 8 months. I think it's going to be something similar like the Randy Orton contract, where it's like, yeah, I'll work these 4, and yeah, you know what, this one, nah, I'm good, I'm going to stay home. This one, I'm not going to work this pay-per-view when no one cares about the product, where it starts dying down a little bit, and then he'll come back for the summer, maybe October, he won't go to that event, go to Crown Jewel, obviously get the Saudi Arabian stadium money, get a cut of that, and then after take another month off. So I think out of the 12 months a year, I think it's safe to say he'll probably be in there for 9 of them.
I like that. I think that's pretty fair. Another thing I got to ask you, man, before we go off, you know, Dexter Lumis wears all black. This is an interesting take for me. I saw on Sports Kita, and I also saw on Twitter. Can you see the Fiend coming back and aligning with Dexter Lumis?
Imagine, yeah, the new member of the Wyatt family. You have Eric Rowan, Strowman, and you bring Dexter Lumis into the fold. That'd be nice. A nice little change.
I mean, he is psychotic. That look,
just... the axe that he pulls out of his jacket.
Yeah. No, just because, man, like we were waiting. We've been waiting for the Fiend Bray Wyatt to come back for what, 2 months now, and Gargano's finally here. So, do you expect to hear Bray Wyatt's name soon?
Yeah, I think so. I think Clash of the Castle. They're gonna probably take advantage of that stadium crowd, and I think we'll probably see. If it's not Bray Wyatt and the Wyatt family together, maybe just Bray Wyatt. And then in the next couple of weeks, you bring in Braun Strowman and Eric Rowan together and makes even more of a big deal. Sasha Banks is another one that probably will see back. And I just think they have to do something at that show, whether it's a title change or a return, like something similar to SummerSlam where they get people talking on social media and boost up like any attention they can get from that.
What do you see with Judgment Day at this pay-per-view?
I think it's, I don't know if it's run its course, but like there's just something about it where they need another younger star in the group. Cause I don't know who the leader is, if it's Finn Balor, Priest, Ripley, like
yeah,
both Priest and Balor, like 40, 41 years old. So like who's going to be the next star to emerge out of there? Like maybe if you put Dominic Mysterio in there and you can build him up. I would have liked to see Rey in there, but I just don't know where they're going to go in the future.
I agree, man. Like another guy that goes full circle, Dexter Lumis again, man. Like that would be a pretty interesting guy to eventually go there. But I think Rhea Ripley's a leader, man. Call me crazy. Just the way that she's been carrying herself, telling Finn and Damien what to do all the time. I think Rhea is actually the centerpiece of Judgment Day, but Finn Balor has to be doing more, man. He doesn't come off as a leader or like a main event type of guy. You know what I mean? I feel like he has to elevate his aura a little bit, his legacy.
Yeah, I agree. Like, do you think they kind of made a mistake calling it Judgment Day? Because when Edge started, it kind of looked like it was another Undertaker group, and now Finn Balor's in it. Do you think they need to transition it out to kind of like what the Bullet Club was and like call it Balor Club or just change something about it?
Yeah, they have to change something. And I know Triple H, big Finn Balor guy. I think maybe after Survivor Series, maybe they even do a Judgment Day Survivor Series match where they maybe bring over like maybe two heels to join a Survivor Series match. I'll say this till like I'm certain he's not going to get a push. I think as long as Finn Balor is doing something and impressing Triple H, I think his ceiling is the highest of any of the three. I think he can have a main event push. I'll, you know, call me crazy, the next SummerSlam. I would not be surprised if we saw Finn in a meaningful feud with like a Seth Rollins again. So to me, I think it only takes one outstanding match and, you know, a match that really exceeds expectations for Triple H to go out and say, hey, look, that's the Finn Balor from 2017. We need him back. Or that's the Finn Balor from 2019 when you feuded with Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble. So I haven't seen that Finn Balor in quite some time. I think everybody in WWE, including myself and you, I think we want to see that. So Judgment Day is great. You know, I love the way the potential between them. But I do agree with you, man. They got to change the name. They got to change the look. And they got to bring the Wyatt family back, I think, in order for it to bring any legitimacy to the group. Can you imagine the Balor Club versus the Wyatt family? I think that'd be fantastic television. So that's just a thought. I'm not a creative guy out there, but that's a thought for me.
Yeah, like just what they have there. Like Shinsuke Nakamura is another one. Like, do you put him to Raw and feud with Finn to like try to change something? Like, there's so many guys that are like there. They just need that opportunity. I think Finn Balor, you nailed it right there. Like, just needs something to impress Triple H, and then he'll go off and running from there.
I'm not worried. See, like, that's the thing with Finn Balor. I'm not worried at all. I think he's going to get his time. I know we've been saying that for like 3 years, but I think now with Triple H in charge, I think he's eventually going to get that opportunity. With Damian Priest, though, love him or hate him, I think he's a sub main eventer at most. I don't see him being a main event type of guy. Can you, like, I think a fair comparison with Priest, call me crazy, is Baron Corbin. Like, he can be in those big-time spots, like, let's say in a Royal Rumble and eliminate a big name, but he'll never be a main eventer on a card. You know what I mean? I just don't see Priest being that guy.
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison. Because, like, Corbin, like, he was Kurt Angle's last match, and what happened after that, like, no one benefited from that. So I see what you mean there. Like, they did put Priest there, like, with Bad Bunny against Miz and Morrison. You would think he would benefit from that. Didn't go anywhere. Just went downhill. Then he goes into this group. And I don't know. It's like the same thing with him, like Baron Corbin. Another name there, as we're talking about, Ron Toronto Edge comes back. Saw Steve Dangle there with a nice photo op with Edge. And he said after the show that next summer in Toronto, he'd like to retire and have his last match. If you're forward booking this, who would you think, or who do you think should be that final match against Edge?
I mean, it should be John Cena, but he's not going to be there. So I'll go with Randy Orton. I think it's perfect setup. I think, you know, with the amount of rest that Orton has had the last couple months, he can be there at least another year. Obviously, he's been doing it for 22 years. So Randy Orton coming back again, I think, at a certain time next year, whether he's a face or a heel, I don't think it matters. I think it's more of the opportunity and the memory. The last match, that's a big deal. So I think you have to put him up against either a very highly up-and-comer, or you put him up against one of the legends that he's feuded with time and time again, whether it's Ray, whether it's Randy Orton, whether it's John Cena. I think regardless, man, it will get the respect, but I'm for sure, if Cena's available, John Cena for sure. I think he's the first option.
Yeah, and especially in Toronto too, like, they have history, all those pay-per-views they had, probably their biggest rival as singles competitors would make sense. But anyone else you think that he, before he retires, that you'd like to see him feud with?
I mean, I would love to see him feud with Finn Balor. That's something, like, one-on-one. I know we're kind of seeing it right now, but one-on-one in a big setting. Another guy that I would love to see is Cody Rhodes. I think Cody Rhodes and Edge would be fireworks. I think the mic work would be great. Both of those guys just bring that passion to the mic. We saw back in April when Cody Rhodes came back and when he said his reason to come back, and he was basically holding back tears. You know, how his dad never won the WWE title. I'm doing it for him. The boat, like, that would just be a passion-driven feud between Cody and Edge. And I think that would be fireworks. So I'll go with Finn and Cody, but there's a number of guys out there that I would love to see Edge feud with.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up here with that. Keep it with Edge. And next week, we'll find out who as a favorite going into that Clash of the Castle pay-per-view, which is going to happen on Saturday, next Saturday. So a lot to look forward to there. And All Out, we'll find out more about that six-man title scene and if Kenny Omega is still looking strong. But that's episode 191, and we'll see you guys next week.